Okay, today we're going to talk about the era, the developments after Churban Beit HaMikdash. Sort of a sequel to what we spoke about last week. We'll make reference to certain of the things that we discussed last week, but actually it's a topic all of its own, and it's a new era. The revolt began in the year 65, that's of the Common Era, and it was a long war. It took 5 years for the war to be over. It took 5 years for Rome to take Yerushalayim and Judea. And of course, they destroyed the Beit HaMikdash at the time. And even after Churban Beit HaMikdash, there was still one territory that was controlled by the Kanaim, by the Zealots, and that was Masada. And Masada was not taken until 72, 2 years later. It took Rome actually 7 years for them to subdue the Judeans. This was a very humiliating experience for Rome. Rome at the time was the mightiest of the countries. There was nothing in any place that could possibly compare to the strength and to the might of the Roman legions. And the fact that little Judea was able to resist Rome for that length of time was something that was totally humiliating. Josephus, when he discusses the war and the siege of Yerushalayim, quotes the generals, the commanders of the Roman legions, and their admonitions to the legions, to the legionnaires, telling them, "Look, well, how will Rome look in the eyes of the world when it takes them that long and it has such a difficult time in subduing Judea?" Was a very, very, it was a decisive war, and it was a difficult war. The defeat of Judea had many ramifications for the entire world, actually, for us, for the Jews. It put us into a galut that lasted for some 2,000 years, and in fact, we're still in the galut of Churban Beit HaMikdash. With all of its tribulations and with all of the experiences that we were put to in the subsequent historic eras, in the medieval period and even the modern era. It also had an important place in the history of Christianity. The church utilized the defeat of the Judeans and the destruction of the temple as a substantiation of their belief. They view this theologically as the divine wrath expressed towards the Jews for their rejection of their God. There was Jesus, and there was the Jewish rejection, there was the crucifixion, and then came soon after Churban Beit HaMikdash, and they viewed this succession of events as something of a divine expression, a divine message to the world. It's interesting, I don't know how many of you ever look at a book of Josephus, but the popular book of Josephus is that one volume work where all of the four books of Josephus are there. And James Whiston, I believe his name is James, I know it's Whiston, he's the editor. He was a very religious Catholic, and he did something very peculiar. When he put the four books of Josephus together, he has first the book of Antiquities, and secondly, he has the book of Wars that Josephus wrote, and then the two other books, Contra Fiona, and then his autobiography, the Vita. The peculiarity is that the first book that Josephus wrote was the Wars of the Jews. The second book that he wrote was the Antiquities of the Jews. And one would expect, if an editor would put the works of Josephus together, then the chronology should be that the first book that he wrote should be first, the second book should be second, and so on. He reverses them. The reason is this. Josephus records the crucifixion in Antiquities. And in the Jewish Wars, he records the destruction. Whiston, being a religious Catholic, wanted to put them in that sequence. First, to record the crucifixion, and that was the Avera, that was the sin, and then the wars recording the destruction, which was the divine wrath, the divine anger at the Jews, the punishment given to the Jews for it. So this became a rather important element in church history and in church teaching. But this is not what I wanted to talk about. There were many consequences of this war that have ramifications with regards to the development of Judaism and Jewish theology, particularly of rabbinic Judaism. With Churban Beit HaMikdash, two of the existing sectarian groups disappeared. The Essenes, which many people believe are the people who were in Qumran, although Larry Schiffman, who had spoken here, disagrees with that. The Essenes, wherever they lived, they disappeared. They no longer existed. The Qumran community, whoever they were, Qumran was destroyed in the year 70, and the people were killed. A few of the people from Qumran went up to Masada, but of course Masada also ended with a disaster. Everybody in Masada was killed. So for all intents and purposes, the Qumran community and the Essene community was gone, and the only thing we have left of them are the Dead Sea Scrolls that were found in the caves right around En Gedi, where the Qumran community existed. Similarly, the Sadducees, the Tzdukim, that we spoke of last week, they disappeared as well. Not that they were killed, but they just disappeared as a group. You have to understand why. The Tzdukim, their role in Judea was a governmental role. They were the Kohanim Gedolim, they were the Kohanim, and they were the heads of state, and they were the governmental officials. Once Judea was destroyed, these people were unemployed. There was no place for them in society. There was no longer a Judea. There was no longer a government. So their ancestry and their foundation for leadership was gone. And as far as their role was concerned, their role disappeared. In addition to this, they as a group were not able to survive as a group after Churban. One of the primary differences between the Pharisees and the Sadducees was regarding eschatological fundamentals. They, the Tzdukim, did not believe in anything of eschatological origin. They did not believe in Mashiach. They did not believe in Schar Va'onesh. They did not believe in anything outside of the normal realm of human experience. This is one of the primary differences between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The reason why they didn't believe in that is because we don't find the foundation for these eschatological fundamentals clearly written in Torah Shebiktav. We don't find them in the Torah. Like, for example, the Gemara in Sanhedrin asks, Triyat HaMeitim Min HaTorah Minayin. How do we know that there's such a concept of resurrection? So the answer is through Drush. Through Drush, we are able to deduce from a Pasuk that there is a concept of Triyat HaMeitim. But if you don't accept the efficacy of Drush, that's Torah Shebaal Peh. If the Tzdukim did not accept these hermeneutical rules of logic and reason with which we're able to deduce things that are not clearly, explicitly written in the Torah, so they didn't have any reason to accept those principles, and they didn't. So to them, Churban Beit HaMikdash was a total national catastrophe. It was something they were not able to fathom, they could not comprehend, and they could not absorb. The Pharisees were able to say, okay, we had a terrible, terrible experience, but Hashem will help. There will be a Goel, there will be a Mashiach, and we're going to see later in our talk that this was very, very vital in their thinking. These people were Rishaim, and they're going to get their thing when the time comes. And they were able to pick themselves up even after this disastrous experience and start anew. The Tzdukim were not able to do that, and they disappeared. They assimilated, they left. We no longer hear of Tzdukim after Churban Beit HaMikdash. The only group that was left really were the Pushim, the Pharisees. And the Pharisees, the Pharisaic approach is of course the approach of Rabbinic Judaism. So when the time comes after Churban Beit HaMikdash for these people, the survivors, to pick up and to begin new development, so the leadership and the people involved in that development inevitably were the Pharisees, and we expect and we anticipate, and indeed we see that all of the subsequent developments are along the Pharisaic direction, the rabbinic direction. We'll see what I mean in a moment. The personality who emerges especially effective at this time is Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was a gadol before Churban in Yerushalayim. The Gemara teaches that before Churban Beit HaMikdash, although the Gemara does not tell us that he held any specific role, we are sure 100% that he was a member of the Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim. There's no doubt about that. But the Gemara tells us that he was a great teacher. He used to teach on the Ma'alot Beit HaMikdash, on the Ma'alot of the Har HaBayit. You know, in the southern, at that southern wall today, when you go to Israel, that southern wall, that huge staircase, this is where the people used to, that's where they used to ascend to go into the Beit HaMikdash. That's where Yochanan ben Zakkai taught. It was like an amphitheater. I mean, I would picture it that the people would sit on those steps, and he would stand over there on the bottom, and he would lecture to them. This is what the implication is in the Gemara. He was a great teacher. The Gemara also has a number of Mishnayot that when there was a debate between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, between the Pushim and the Tzdukim, Yochanan ben Zakkai was the one who was the spokesman for the Pharisees. He was the one who debated the Sadducees on behalf of the Pushim. So he was a phenomenal person before Churban Beit HaMikdash. But his career changes altogether, like a midlife change with Churban. After the destruction, I don't want to talk now about his political views regarding the revolution. If you're going to ask about it, I'll be more than happy to talk about it, but this is not really something that I had intended to do. Nor do I want to talk about his exit from Yerushalayim. We have four different rabbinic sources regarding that exit. Josephus doesn't say a word about it. But bottom line is that he left Yerushalayim during the siege, and in some way or other he got to Yavne. The traditional story is that he appeared before Aspasianus, before Vespasian, and he asked him, Tein li Yavne v'chachameha, and Vespasian graciously said, okay, I'm going to give you the city of Yavne, go and do whatever you would like. I don't want to talk about that either. It's a very difficult thing to understand. There are different variations of the story. Again, if you want to talk about it, we'll talk about it later, you will ask. But it's not really pertinent to what I wanted to speak today. He gets to Yavne, and Yochanan ben Zakkai is really to be credited as the savior of Judaism at that particular time. I mean, it's hard to imagine what would have happened to the people and what would have happened to Yahadut and Torah and to Mitzvot if it would not have been for the developments of Yochanan ben Zakkai in Yavne. What he did was, he in advance prepared a successive center to Yerushalayim. He was convinced, there's no doubt about it, that Yerushalayim was going to be destroyed, the Beit HaMikdash was going to be destroyed, and he was concerned as to what will happen after. And he made preparations. He prepared for that Churban. And as soon as Churban took place, Yavne became the center. In Yavne, he established the Sanhedrin of 71. No place ever had a Bet Din of 71 people other than Yerushalayim. We had a Bet Din of 21 people and Bet Din of 3 people and what have you. But this is the first time where we have outside of Yerushalayim a Bet Din of 71. He introduced, as we're going to see, a number of the temple practices and practices that were limited and restricted to the Beit HaMikdash and Yerushalayim into Yavne. He established a successive center to Yerushalayim where people studied. Tefillah was developed in those days. The Shmona Esrei was completed after Churban Beit HaMikdash. The 19th benediction was added somewhat later, also after Churban Beit HaMikdash. He was responsible for saving Judaism. We don't see immediately the rise of rabbinic Judaism to the extent of a development of Talmudic literature. That comes later. There's something else that has to happen before that. You see, you have to understand that although the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, and although autonomy and sovereignty was no longer part of the Jewish experience, and the Jews no longer had a political entity, a territorial entity, a territorial state of their own, the idea of rebuilding and resuming and regaining sovereignty and nationhood and peoplehood was still very, very much alive. They did not accept Galut. They did not accept Chulban. And Yochada ben Zakkai was largely responsible for that. He wanted to instill within the people that hope that soon the Goel will come and Geula will come to them and they will rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Much of the effort that Yochada ben Zakkai did in those decades after Chulban was to maintain that nationalistic concept and to nurture that desire to return to Yerushalayim and to resume independence. People don't realize it, but the Gemara is very explicit. We are able to see what Yochanan ben Zakkai wanted to accomplish in Yavne through his takanot, through his innovation. What is a takana? A takana is not just a rabbinic innovation. A takana is a rabbinic innovation litaken, in order to fix something, in order to add something, to perfect an imperfection. The imperfection that he perceived in his era was the potential loss of interest in national sovereignty. And what he set himself to do in his takanot was to regain that interest and to nurture that interest in a very real way. He did it legalistically, but it had practical manifestations. I'll give you an example. He was determined to keep the memory, the recollection, the activities, the conduct of the Beit HaMikdash alive in the people in Yavne. For example, there was a halakha that Rosh Hashanah that coincides with Shabbat in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, in the Beit HaMikdash, they sounded the shofar, even if it was Shabbat. However, b'mdina, outside, no. He went and he introduced to Yavne a halacha, a takana, that if Rosh Hashanah coincides with Shabbat, if this is the place where Bet Din is, we sound the shofar. He went and transplanted and transferred a temple activity, a temple halacha, over to Yavne. He had a problem, mind you. Don't think that he had an easy time. Rabbis today don't have easy times. He didn't have an easy time either. The Gemara writes that he had people who opposed this. The B'nai B'Teira opposed it. But through some sort of an intrigue, he got his thing through. The Gemara writes, Pam Achat, it happened once, where Rosh Hashanah and Shabbat coincided, and Yochanan ben Zakkai said, Nitka, let's sound the shofar. And the B'nai B'Teira came and they said, wait a second, let's talk about it. Yochanan ben Zakkai knew darn well that if they're going to have a committee, sit down and talk about it, before you know it, it'll be Sukkot, you know, and the Rosh Hashanah will be gone. So he said, wait, he said, listen, I'll tell you what, he says, let's sound the shofar, it's Rosh Hashanah, and then we'll talk about it. So that's what they did. The Gemara says this. So they sounded the shofar. And then the B'nai B'Teira came and said, okay, let's now talk about it. He says, forget it. The shofar was sounded, B'Yavne already, and once the ma'aseh was done, once the precedent was set, there's no need to talk about it anymore. But that's just an interesting sideline, yes. He was the Nasi. He was the Nasi. We know that he was the Nasi because he had the title Rabban. Rabban was a title that was given only to the Nasi. Sure. You had Rabban Gamliel Hazaken, who was the Nasi in Yerushalayim, and then we had his son Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, who was the Nasi at the time of Chulban Beit HaMikdash. Then there was Chulban. You have Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, and then you have Rabban Gamliel of Yavne who follows him. and that every Nasi had the title Rabban. From that point, from the time of Rabban Gamliel Hazaken, every Nasi had the title of Rabban. Before that, they didn't have that title. Like Hillel didn't have Rabban Hillel. The Zugot, when we read of the Zugot in Perek, they didn't have. But from the time of Rabban Gamliel Hazaken, every Nasi, that was the title reserved for the Nasi. So being that the Gemara speaks of Yochanan ben Zakkai as Rabban, so we are 100% sure. I mean, that he was, his title was, that although he was not in the lineage of the Nasiut, he was not like the son of Shimon ben Gamliel. Tosavot asks, how come Yochanan ben Zakkai became the Nasi? Rabban Gamliel should have become. Gamliel, the son of Shimon ben Gamliel, should have been. So Tosavot says that Shimon ben Gamliel was too young. He was a youngster. So Yochanan ben Zakkai was like the interim Nasi until Gamliel became mature. And then he stepped back, and Gamliel resumed the post of the Nasiut. Tosafot says that. I mean, we can accept that. There's no problem. He was the Nasi. Anyway, we see here an attempt on his part to introduce temple practices to Yavne. Not because he wanted to make Yavne an important city, but he wanted to keep temple practices alive. We're going to see it in a moment how that becomes even more explicit. Yavne was not where Yavne is now. Yavne was not far from Lud. Lud and Yavne were close together. In old Lud, and Lud, the old Lud is not the Lud airport either, but it's not far from there. Lud and Yavne were the two cities rather close to each other. A second takana that Yochanan ben Zakkai was responsible for was regarding the Arba Minim, the Lulav and the Esrog and the Hadassim and the Arabot. In the time of the Beit HaMikdash, the mitzvah of Lulav was observed for 7 days only in the Beit HaMikdash, only in Yerushalayim in the Beit HaMikdash. A second takana that Yochanan ben Zakkai was responsible for was that now, but after Churban, even in Yavne, outside of Yerushalayim, we will observe that mitzvah for 7 days. And the Gemara writes, why? Zecher leMikdash, in order to remember the Mikdash. Comes a third takana that I don't want to discuss too much now, although we talked a little bit about it earlier before we started the talk, and that it's a little too complicated. It's regarding Yom HaOmer, Yom HaOmer with Chadash. Over there he also introduced a takana in relation to the temple, but over there he's very expressive. And he says the reason why he introduced this is because Meherai Yibaneh HaMikdash, because soon the Beit HaMikdash will be rebuilt. And this gives us the comprehension, the understanding as to what his policy was and what his goal was. His goal was to keep, not just to keep the Beit HaMikdash alive, but to instill within the people the hope that soon the Beit HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt. That although they suffered a destruction, nevertheless, the nationalistic concept is to be kept alive. Now, he did this legalistically, but he obviously had a phenomenal impact on the people, because this nationalism was very much alive. The historians indicate, the contemporary historians indicate, that in the course of the six decades after Churban Beit HaMikdash, whenever the opportunity presented itself, there was a physical confrontation between the Jews and Romans. Constantly, on a small level, on a small basis, on a local level. Even the Mishnah speaks about Quietus, Quitus, Quitus. Quietus was one of the Roman generals in an area, and there was a clash. There were constant clashes, although the Jews were now an ethnic minority in the Roman Empire. Judea now was a part of the Roman Empire. It was nothing as far as the Jews were concerned, yet there was constant fighting. Of course, yes, in Eretz Yisrael. They were not in Yerushalayim, but they were in Eretz Yisrael. They were in Eretz Yisrael. There were people who were taken away, who went into other areas of the Roman Empire, but there was a very large concentration of Jews right in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, yeah. This explains Bar Kokhba. Who you brought up Bar Kokhba? Somebody brought up Bar Kokhba again earlier. You did. This explains, you know, the historians have a phenomenal difficulty. How is it that the year 135, 132 and a half of the Common Era, after suffering two major defeats by Rome, one major defeat by Rome, the great revolt against Rome, where did these people have the chutzpah to stand up against the Romans? It takes chutzpah. Here they didn't have a government. They didn't have a militia. They didn't have generals. They were a group of people in the Roman Empire. Where did they have the chutzpah to stand up against Rome at this particular time? But if you view it from the theological perspective and from the developmental perspective of the Jews at that time, it's easily understood. These people really felt that the time for Geula is coming. Explain to you why. To them, the concept of Galut was 70 years. 70 years. They only had one Galut. From the time they became a people, I'm not talking about Avdut Mitzrayim, but from the time they came to Judea, they had one Galut. It was Churban Bayit Rishon, the first temple was destroyed, and they went into Galut. That Galut lasted 70 years. So actually, it didn't even last 70 years. It was from the year 586 until 538. In 538, Korash permitted them to return. But it did last for 70 years, because Galut means Jewish life without a Beit HaMikdash. They may have returned in the year 538, but the Beit HaMikdash, the second one, was not built until 516. So they were without a Beit HaMikdash from the time of Churban, 586, until they built Bayit Sheni, which was in the year 516. So to those people, the concept of Galut was 70 years. Now here you have, in the year 70, a Churban again. When we come to the year 135, it's almost 70 years. Almost 70 years. And if throughout this time, you have a Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, and you have a Sanhedrin that keeps pounding at the people, Mehera Yibaneh HaMikdash, soon the Beit HaMikdash will be rebuilt, and so on, then when the time of Geula comes, then who cares whether you're a minority, whether you have a militia, whether you have an army, whether the army is trained? If we're speaking of Geula, a divine redemption, all of these questions don't count. And we know that the Bar Kokhba rebellion was a messianic rebellion. It was a messianic element in the Bar Kokhba rebellion. The Gemara writes this in the Bavli, in the Yerushalmi, that Rabbi Akiva, when he saw Bar Kokhba approaching, Rabbi Akiva would say, he would refer to him as Malka de Meshicha, Melech HaMashiach. Bar Kokhba was viewed as Melech HaMashiach. You asked me, Maurice, earlier how many people were involved, and I told you hundreds of thousands. That means almost everybody. Why? Who goes to fight just like that? But if it's a messianic war, everybody goes with a winner. Everybody's going to be involved. He had a huge support. There were people who opposed him. The Gemara writes that it was Yochanan ben Turta disagreed with Rabbi Akiva. I said, forget it, this is not going to happen, he's a Pashiach, and so on. But Rabbi Akiva was the popular figure, and Rabbi Akiva was the one who amassed the people and popularized Rabbi Bar Kokhba. Right? The Bar Kokhba rebellion, unfortunately, resulted in defeat. That defeat was really responsible for the rise and the development of Rabbinic Judaism. It started before with Yochanan ben Zakkai, but the emphasis was elsewhere. The emphasis was still on regaining independence. I read a number of years ago, the Union of Orthodox Congregations has a magazine, I think it's called Jewish Action. Is that what it's called? Jewish Action, I think. And there was someone there, I don't remember his name, who suggests that Yochanan ben that Bar Kokhba even already built the Beit HaMikdash, or started to build the Beit HaMikdash. I don't know whether that's true or not. But there's no doubt that this was the primary focus of attention, the regaining of sovereignty, the regaining of political independence and political nationhood. Once Churban Beitar was experienced, and the Battle of Beitar was the decisive battle in the Bar Kokhba rebellion, that battle had a phenomenal impact on Jewish life and on Jewish history. We see this not only from a historical perspective, but even from the Talmudic perspective, when the Mishnah in Ta'anit discusses and lists the different national tribulations, national catastrophes that took place on Tisha B'Av. So it lists, and it's true, there's a reason for it. Because what that defeat did was it totally eliminated that nationalistic direction on the part of the people that dominated their attention in the previous era. Of course, they still believe the Mashiach. Our people always believe the Mashiach. Ani ma'amin be'emunah shleima b'biyat ha-Mashiach, and so on and so forth. Yapapi she'it ma'meya, and kol zeh ani ma'amin. They believed in it. Everybody believed in it. But it no longer dominated their lives. They suddenly realized that Galut is not necessarily Galut of 70 years. And they sort of resigned themselves to the fact that they're going to live in Galut and they don't know how long it's going to take until they'll be redeemed, whenever that redemption will take place. And they made a decision. This was made, although we don't have the decision formally recorded, but we could see from what happened that this decision was made, that we had better pay attention and devote and invest our efforts to surviving as a people in Galut, as a minority. And this is what they did. We don't find after Bar Kokhba any more skirmishes with Rome. Militancy is gone. As a matter of fact, I think somebody mentioned this last week, that in the Gemara, in the passages which are post-Bar Kokhba passages, we already find antagonism and objection to Jewish militancy against the powers amongst whom they live. And from that point and on, they become militarily a passive people. But they become aggressive in a different area, and that's regarding their cultural development. It's then that the real essence of the Talmudic era emerges, and all of their effort is in this cultural development. It's then that the academies, yeshivot, become the super institutions. And it's at this point, with Mishnah, shortly after, under the Nesiut of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, is written down. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi went against tradition to put that Mishnah down, because Torah Sheba'al Peh had to remain Ba'al Peh. But he realized that after a defeat by Rome twice, we don't know what happens next, and we don't know what kind of anti-Jewish legislation Rome is going to come up with in the future, and if our traditions are going to remain oral, all you need is one generation that doesn't study and everything is forgotten. So he took advantage of a period of tranquility. Midrash writes that he had a special relationship with Antoninus Pius, who was the emperor at that particular time. And as a result of that, there was a peace. There was a peaceful relationship between the Jews and the Romans. And he took advantage of that. So he and his Talmidim were able to gather all the notes and put the Mishnah down. And from that point and on, all emphasis was placed on study, on elucidation, on Jewish law. On Jewish law. And on maintaining the purity of the Jewish tradition. And it's all Pharisaic. It's all Pharisaic. We may find machlokiyot, dissensions, argumentation in the Gemara, but these are not arguments. These are discussions. These are legal debates. These are all Pharisaic debates. We don't find any more debates between Pharisees and Sadducees, and we don't find other sectarians coming into the picture, not until the 7th century when the Kaga'im come forth. But up until the 7th century, from the 1st century, from the 2nd century to the 7th century, there is constant study and constant rabbinic, Talmudic, religious, cultural development, and that's all we read about. And it's in the course of that time that the concept of Yahadut becomes crystallized, and that the basic foundation for what ultimately becomes the Shulchan Aruch, the approach to Jewish law, whether it's the Ramah or whether it's the Beit Yosef, doesn't make any difference. It's all based on the same text. It's all based on the same material which was developed at that time. This is what they did then, after Bar Kokhba, was provide the wherewithal for the Jewish people to be able to survive even a galut of 2,000 years. That they should be able to maintain themselves as a people without a territory and without a government, and a people dispersed throughout the world. This could not have happened without this phenomenal cultural development that served to unite our people as a nation. You know that there was a historian, his name was Shimon Dubnov. Maybe some of you heard of him. Simon Dubnov, Shimon Dubnov. He died at the very beginning of the war. He's a rather recent, at the beginning of the war. He was a socialist. He was a socialist. As a matter of fact, he was the ideologist for the Jewish socialist group called the Bund, if you're familiar with modern history. We had Jewish socialists as well. And he was a Jewish ideologist for them. He gave them something of a Jewish character because they were atheistic altogether. He wrote a tremendous amount on nationalism. He was more than a historian, he was a historiographer. He didn't just write facts. He spoke about history. And he tried to explain history and tried to explain how historical forces emerge with certain ways and why they develop in certain ways. He discusses nationalism. He writes as follows. Part of it we can accept, part of it of course we reject. He writes that there are three phases of nationalistic development. He says the first phase of nationalism is something that we hardly find in the real world. It's something that you have to imagine. It's the most elementary form of nationalistic development. He says, picture 100 people on a boat, stranded on an island. And these people, every one of them comes from a different country, speaks a different language. Nobody has anything in common with the other. They can't even communicate with each other. So the only thing that serves to bind them together as a group is the fact that they're on a piece of land, on one piece of land. This is, in other words, where the territory is the only bond that binds them. It's the only cohesive force. Says this is the lowest form of nationalism, where the only thing they have in common is a piece of land, a country. He says, as these people continue to live together, they experience common experiences. There's a storm, there's a hurricane, there's a flood, there's a drought, there's prosperity. So they begin to develop a common history. And then they find a need of communication, so they develop a common language. Once they're able to communicate, they develop the arts, music, poetry, and what have you, or literature. They develop a culture. So now, these people have two forces that bind them together, a territory and a cultural force. This is normally what every nationality has. Every nation has a country. And it has a culture, a history, arts, whatever it may be. But that's only the second phase. What he writes is the third phase, the ultimate phase of nationalistic development, is when the cultural bond develops to such an extent that even if the territory is removed and the people are dispersed, that cultural bond still is able to hold them together as a people. That's the ultimate in nationalistic development. And he says the only people in the world who attain that third phase of nationalistic development are the Jewish people. That their culture, in the course of this era that we spoke of today, developed to such an extent that even in dispersion throughout the world, and confronted with all sorts of tribulations and humiliations and restrictions and what have you, the cultural bond was so strong that they're still together as a people. If he would have stopped at this point, we would have all applauded him. But then he goes further and he says, and therefore you cannot be a Zionist and you cannot aspire for a state, because if you're going to go, if you're going to aspire for a state, for a Jewish state, then what are you in fact doing? You're moving from phase three back to phase two, because you still need a territorial bond. He says, this is not what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to stay where we are without a territory, and we have an obligation to continue to develop this cultural bond which is ours. He was consistent, you should know, because he had the opportunity to go to Palestine. At that time it was Palestine, and to escape the war. And he said, no, my place is in Germany. And he stayed, and he was killed. He was killed there. So at least we can credit him with honesty. But up to that point when he began to take a political stand regarding Zionism, he was very correct. Because what happened in this era was, we were given the wherewithal, we were given the instruments, we were given the means with which to be able to survive as a people, even if we didn't have a territory. Of course, once we attain a territory, as we did, there is a whole new posture, there's a new dignity, there's a new meaning that's given. Of course, we still await not only Yerushalayim, but Yerushalayim Habnuya, but that'll be even more, but that's beyond that. But nevertheless, this era gave us the ability to be able to survive in Galut. And this they learned after the revolt of Bar Kokhba, with the rise of rabbinic Judaism and rabbinic activity. I don't know that it differed. Pardon? I don't know that it differed. I don't know that there was any essential difference. The only differences that there may have been were, of course, the mitzvot that were kliyot ba'aretz. There was no Yerushalayim, there was no avodah, there was no korbanot. So now tefillah assumed a very special significance. Okay, so here you have one area of difference. During the Second Temple era, tefillah was present, but was not that important. It was not even structured, actually, completely structured. The Gemara writes, although that the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah who functioned in the time of Bayit Sheni were involved in the Seder HaTfilah, but it seems that the real Seder HaTfilah did not really come to be, and the Chiyuvim and everything else did not come to be until after. Tfilah assumed a very special significance. As far as Tfilin is concerned, I mean, there's no doubt they had Tfilin in the time of Bayit Sheni and they had Tfilin after. I don't know that there were any major differences in terms of observance. The concept of limud assumed a special significance. Limud was different. The whole concept of limud was different. The study, the learning of Torah was different. In the time of Bayit Sheni, limud Torah was sort of restricted to a few people, the people who sat in the yeshiva and who sat at the feet of the rabbanim, the rabbeim, and listened. It was an oral kind of a transmission. The common person did not sit and learn. He observed, but he did not sit and learn. After Churban Beit HaMikdash, once the Mishnah was written and we had texts from which to study, the concept of Limud Torah became widespread. It was also emphasized to a far greater degree, because now Limud was important for everyone, because this is what is going to keep us together. Similarly, the concept of Halakha underwent not revisions, but underwent development and concretization. Again, because now it became written down. Once something is written down, it's got to be clear. People knew before what to do, because they were told, you have to do it this way, you have to do it that way. Now they were able to see, this is the way. Now they had guides, this is the way it needed to be done. Understand also that what is written down in the Mishnah, which serves the base as the basis for the Gemara, this is not something that Yehuda HaNasi did in the year 200. He didn't write it. He didn't write the Mishnah. The word to be used is that he redacted the Mishnah. He compiled the Mishnah. He collected all of notes. People took notes. People took notes. The Talmidim took notes. And he collected notes from Tkufat Bayit Sheni. The Tanaitic era did not start with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. It ended with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. From Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and on, we already speak of the Amoraim. The Tanaim lived in the time of Tkufat Bayit Sheni. So basically, the teachings of the Mishnah reflect the teachings and the practices of Bayit Sheni. There wasn't that tremendous a difference. It only underwent a development, a further development, an intellectual development, an academic development, and a clarification, more of a clarification of Limud and of Halakha, which did not exist before. Well, this certainly is the tendency, not only in terms of theological development, but even of the pragmatism of the historical experience itself. For example, you started with Bayit Rishon. I don't know too much about Bayit Rishon because we don't have too many sources regarding it. But in the time of Bayit Rishon, all of the Jews lived in Eretz Yisrael. You can never say all. Historically, there's no such thing as all or never. There's always an exception. We have an exception to that because they found that little community in the Elephantine. It was called Yev. Yev was a little community of Jewish mercenaries in the Egyptian army, where they established themselves in the Dnipro Valley. And that was a little exilic community at the time of Bayit Rishon, at the time of the First Temple. But for all intents and purposes, in the time of the First Temple, there was no diaspora. Everybody lived in Eretz Yisrael. All Jews lived in Eretz Yisrael. So here we have a nation of people, everything centralized and centered around one particular area. That's where they were. So there you have a religion which is nationalized, right? It's the center. The Beit HaMikdash was the center of Bayit Rishon, especially of Judea, not so much of the northern kingdom, but in Judea, in the southern kingdom, which is the decisive kingdom. Then you come to Bayit Sheni, although there is a return, and the Beit HaMikdash is built, but now you don't find that situation anymore. You find a very nice, a large community in Eretz Yisrael in Judea, but you also have a Jewish community in Alexandria, south of Judea. You have a Jewish community in Antioch, in Syria, north of Judea. And you have a phenomenal Jewish community in Babylonia, in Iraq. Hagola, when the Gemara speaks of Hagola, the exile, speaks of Babel. The Babylonian community was a very strong community, both in terms of affluence as well as in terms of political influence. It's pretty much similar to the situation today, the relationship between the State of Israel and, let's say, the Jewish community in America. There was a very strong exilic diaspora community. Religion had to undergo a change in certain ways as a result of that, because it could no longer be centered and centralized in one nation. It had to become relevant outside of the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael as well. We even have substantiation for that, but I don't know whether I want to go into it. We'll see. After Churban Beit HaMikdash, Bayit Sheni, we have only a diaspora community. So look at the succession of events and the succession of developments. We have first a country with people, then you have a country with people with a dispersion, and then you have only a dispersion. This answers your question. The demographic situation of the Jews in the course of these 3 years indicates the development that Judaism as a nationalism, and as a theology, the development that it had to undergo. Yes. Which era? Yes. You mean in the second Commonwealth?
Yes.
Of course not. I mean, we spoke about that a little bit last week, when we spoke about the confrontation between Hellenism and Judaism. You mean after Churban Beit HaMikdash? Well, at that time, I mean, they didn't have day schools in the academies that they had then. They learned only Limudei Kodesh. But at the same time, the Gemara writes that there were people who studied Hellenistic literature and who were obligated to study Hellenistic literature. For example, the Gemara writes that Beit Rabban Gamliel, that the family of Rabban Gamliel, being that they were the Nisiyim, and they had to frequently visit the Roman courts on behalf of the people, then they had to appear as intellectual, as educated, and as knowledgeable. And they had to study Yevanit. They had to study Greek, and not only Greek as a language, but they had to study the cultural elements of Greece and of Rome as well, in order to project themselves as proper representatives of the people. How many of the others were involved in the secular education and the secular culture? The sources don't indicate. I would say no. I would say relatively few did. Relatively few did. I think that there were more Jews involved in secular studies during Tkufat Bayit Sheni than after. Yeah. Because afterwards, again, the Sadducees, the Tzdukim, were gone. They were the ones who were primarily involved in this kind of a Hellenistic approach. If now everything became Pharisaic, then the attention and the effort and the emphasis was on Limudei Kodesh. We don't find people involved, except for those circumstances, for those people, for those individuals, those families, where it became a necessity. And then they were trained specifically for that. I don't know that he chose it. I don't know that he chose it. All right, I don't call me an apikoles. We have four rabbinic sources regarding Yochanan ben Zakkai and Vespasian. Three of them suggest that he asked for Yavne. One does not mention Yavne at all. One doesn't say anything about Yavne at all. There was a professor of history at Hebrew University, and his name was Gedaliahu Alon. He was a great historian, tremendous historian. He did specific work on this particular era and paid specific attention to Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai and the developments. He suggests that Yochanan ben Zakkai did not ask for Yavne. He suggests, first of all, he says, if Yochanan ben Zakkai would have asked Vespasian for Yavne, and he told him why he wanted it, as it says, because I want to go there and I want to study and I want to be koveya beit tefila, I want to koveya, make a liturgical development and so on, I want to preserve Judaism, and Vespasian so graciously gave it to him, he says, then that should have constituted at least one full chapter in Josephus's book. Josephus, in his Jewish Wars, Josephus was commissioned to write his Jewish Wars by Rome. And that book is biased in favor of Rome. Whenever the opportunity presents itself, and even if the opportunity does not present itself, he projects Rome's approach in a very, very beautiful light. If here, Rome was so gracious, and it actually gave Yochanan ben Zakkai the privilege and the recognition to be able to preserve Judaism forever and ever. That should have been a whole chapter. And rightfully so, rightfully so. He says that this did not happen just that way, and he substantiates it. You see, Josephus is a very difficult book to read because he's very wordy, and he wrote a lot of pages. So you read and you read and you read, but you miss things that he says. But sometimes there are things that he says that are important. He points to something in Josephus. The Romans, when they besieged the city, when they went to war, not only with Judea, but whenever they went to war, they had a method. Their method was that they would put a siege around the city, and they would stay there as long as necessary. And then they would take a city nearby, and they would empty it of its inhabitants, or at least empty part of it of its inhabitants, so that if people would escape from the besieged city, this is where they would put them for the time being. It was like a prison city. It wasn't a concentration camp. I mean, there were no things like that happening. There were no atrocities like that. But they were held under surveillance in that city. He shows in Josephus one sentence or two sentences that when Vespasian came and placed the siege around Jerusalem, he took two cities, Lydda, Lydda, which is Lud, and Yamnia, Jamnia, which is Yavne. And he placed therein the people who left Jerusalem. What he suggests is Yochanan ben Zakkai was a pacifist. Yochanan ben Zakkai was against the revolution. He knew Jerusalem was going to be destroyed, and he had to get out of there, and he had to do something. And he went together with others, and he was sent to Yavne. He could just as well have been sent to Lud. And maybe what he did in Yavne, he would have been able to accomplish in Lud. It's interesting that what Alon says does not detract from Yochanan ben Zakkai. It even adds to his gadlut, to his greatness. Because according to the other approach, and that's Jacob Neusner, who's hardly a historian, if Yochanan ben Zakkai went to Yavne with Rome's recognition and with jurisdiction, because Vespasian, who became the emperor in Rome during the siege, told him, go there and do what you want. You have my permission. You have power. It's no big deal what he did. He was able to do. He had recognition from the major power. But if he was sent to a place and he took advantage of the situation on his own and he was able to achieve what he did, then he becomes a tremendous gadol. What Alon suggests is that this entire episode was romanticized after Yochanan ben Zakkai accomplished and achieved, it became romanticized and somewhat embellished. This is his approach. So when you ask me why did he choose Yavne, I don't know why, but from the other approach, from the other side, he chose Yavne. Or why would he have chosen Yavne? Because Yavne, from earlier years, was a Beit Vad L'Chachamim. Yavne obviously had many, many scholars before, during Kufat Bayit Sheni, while the Beit HaMikdash was in existence. And if Yochanan ben Zakkai would have the choice of a city to succeed Yerushalayim, then he certainly would choose a city that already had a reputation, a scholarly and academic reputation from before. This is what the other historians suggest in answer to your question. Yes? After the fall of Beitar, the pivotal figures were the Nisim. That's when the heads of the academies, they were the heads of the academies, but also the heads of the community. I mean, the Nasi was not just an academic leader, he was also the leader of the existing Jewish community. They then became the pivotal figures. And there were a number of the then there was only one Asi, and you had Shimon ben Gamliel, and you had Gamliel, the most powerful of the Nasiim was Yehuda Hanasi. He was under the ministry of Yehuda Hanasi, the Nasiut really achieved its zenith in terms of power and in terms of influence. But all the Nasiim became pivotal figures. They were the ones around whom everything revolved.